curated to encourage leaders at all levels to be their best selves and to bring a fresh, curious perspective to today's issues in business and culture. Our goal is to equip listeners with the resources to always move forward.
Welcome to the Always Forward Leadership Podcast. I'm Carla Soans, and I am psyched about this next interview because this is my favorite author and favorite public speaker. He's going to give an interview himself, but Ron, what does the listening audience need to know about your interview with the great John Acuff?
So they got to listen to the whole podcast. We've got a book giveaway in the middle of it for 5 signed copies of John's latest book, Finisher. And we tell you on the podcast how to win those books. So give it a listen. Hey, welcome to the Always Forward Leadership Podcast. I'm Ron Kitchens, and I'm so pumped to have my friend, thought leader, comedian extraordinaire, best-selling author with us, John Acuff. John, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ron.
So we got, you know, I always have questions pre-done that to ask about, but this is also the first time that I've ever so known the author or the person I was interviewing, and I went, I don't know what to ask him that we haven't talked about before. So I actually did the Twitter thing of, hey, I'm going to have John on today on the podcast. And so I have like 47 Twitter questions that we'll never get to, but people ask really good questions. I actually copied Little Debbie into it, but hoping that I would get her to like make a comment. But once again, Little Debbie and Wendy are both hanging me up on my retweets, but
that's funny.
So, you know, one of the questions that always comes to me is, how do you describe who John Acuff is today? Because when my John Acuff was a really funny writer who wrote stuff about Christians and really added light to my day when I would read him. But then you've become so much more than that. And, you know, now, you know, I'll plug you 2 sold out shows, comedy shows. You're an amazing writer. I actually have people who are now telling me things that know because we have a connection about your parenting style. So you're like the Martha Stewart of cool right now. So
that's funny.
So how do you describe who you are and what you do now?
Yeah. So I think at the heart of what I do is I put handles on ideas so that people can actually pick them up and go use them. I believe we have enough ideas in the world. We just don't have handles on them. So I love to take seemingly complex solutions or complex situations and find kind of simple ways to talk about them. And I use humor to do that. And so a lot of what I do is go, oh, wow, you know, for my last book, Finish. Okay, finishing is really challenging. People told me that over and over again. How do you actually finish your goals? What does it look like? And so I worked with a PhD and we studied that. And I was able to say, okay, if you do this handful of things, you improve your odds of finishing. You know, and one of them was if you make what you do fun. And so then when I get to have fun is by adding humor to that so that one, you actually engage with it, that you understand it, that you remember it. And so that's kind of been my niche. And so now what I get to do is I get to travel the world and share ideas. I like to say I'm an overthinker. I have a lot of thoughts about a lot of things. And for some people, when they overthink, it kind of freezes them or paralyzes them or it spins them out. For me, I've figured out how to funnel that into productive ways to have a really fun life where I get to connect with folks in Kalamazoo or Lisbon, Portugal, all kind of all over the place and say, okay, what's something we want to change? How can an idea that we turn into action actually do that? And how do I make it really, really funny? My niche are kind of practical things you can do that are delivered in a humorous way. That's kind of how I say what I do. That was a long answer. That wouldn't fit on a business card.
But I love that handles on the ideas. I think that's gold. You know, Alex Phillips, who wrote in on Twitter at Big Dog Burleson, asked the question, writing the book Finish, what was the hardest part to write as it dealt with your own struggles? And he goes on to say how big a fan he is of the book and you. So maybe not just that book, but what's the hardest part of writing for you?
Yeah, I'm writing a book right now. Like this morning, I spent 3 hours writing. The hardest part for me is writing a book that's true to me not the book I think a great author would write. It's really challenging for me. I heard a poet named David White, who's just brilliant. He works with corporations to kind of help them figure out the heart of the work they're doing. He's this Welsh poet, just like the best accent ever. But he said he has to kind of circle around an idea when he's writing it and tighten the circle, tighten the circle, tighten the circle. And so for me, those big wide circles where you're like, I kind of think the idea is sort of like this, and it's really tempting, Ron, to write this formulaic, like, if you do these 7 steps, your life will change automatically, which isn't true. Life is messier than that and more beautiful than that. And so that's the hard part for me. So my process right now, writing-wise, looks like I talk to my wife for like half an hour before I write, and she kind of gives me some feedback. And then I write for 3 hours, and then I go jog. And while I jog, like in the endorphins and being out there, I realize, oh, wait, that idea I said wasn't true. Or I took a shortcut, and I need to do the work of getting in there and really creating something that helps people. And then I come back and I kind of rewrite. But I would say the hardest part for me is writing what's an authentic book in my voice versus I think this is what a smart author would write. And then I end up, you know, kind of as this parody of a smart author. And that's not, that creates a bad book. So it takes me a little while to get to the truth.
Yeah, we all can't write John Maxwell's books. There's a reason
I'm a terrible John Maxwell. I'm like the worst Gary Vee. I'm a terrible, you know, like there's a long list of people I'm terrible at being. I'm a great John Acuff when I'm brave enough to just be that.
So you mentioned that you write every day. So somebody who you introduced me to that work, Brian Koppelman, talks a lot about write pages. Every morning he's got to get up and he's got morning pages. He writes 5 pages a day. Is that what you look like? It's not a productive day if you're not up writing?
No, I mean, I've had to learn to kind of balance that with my travel schedule. I think one of the best things you can give yourself as a producer, and I don't, you know, whether you're a writer, whether you're an event planner, whether you're an analyst for an oil company in Houston, I think one of the things you need to give yourself is kindness. And kindness for me looks like, you know what? If I have to, okay, let's say that's last Thursday, I spoke at an event and it was an awesome event. It was in Nashville. I had to meet the client at 7:30 in the morning, which means, you know, if Nashville is trying to figure out if it has a traffic problem or not, it's not a real traffic problem because like I lived in Atlanta. Nashville traffic is adorable, but we're still trying to figure it out. So I had to leave the house at about 6:30 because I was like, you know what? I want to be there on time. I'd rather the client be like, wow, you've been here 15 minutes versus show up late. So I left the house at about 6:30, which meant I got up at 6. And I wasn't, if I wasn't being kind to myself, I would have said, okay, I have to write from 4:30 to 5:30 or my day hasn't counted. And so what I'm learning is to consistently write on the days I can write, but to also forgive myself that, you know what, that day had a name and it was called serve the heck out of that client. And I, you know, I feel satisfied about that. And maybe that afternoon I was able to get an hour of writing, but that day, I went right from there to the airport and I flew to Dallas. But I actually did write that afternoon for an hour in Dallas in my hotel. So I found it. But even if I hadn't, I wouldn't have beat myself up.
That's awesome. No, I think that gives us all permission. I love that idea of giving yourself kindness. Yeah, that's really important. You know, one of the things, though, that I think gives you a little space, and you wrote about it, I think in Finnish, but Stephen Morris, who is Steve P. Morris on Twitter, asks about the idea of, it says, does his advice to cut your goal in half change when in the context of leadership versus personal achievement?
Well, it really depends on the type of goal. And so the big heart of cutting your goal in half was in response to how bad we are at one part of a goal. There's really kind of 4 parts I like to think about. There's the results you want. There's the motivation that's going to be kind of your passion, your fuel. There are the actions you're going to take to get there. And there's the timeline. How long are you going to give yourself? Now, in a personal goal, Ron, I have control over all of those. In a corporate goal or maybe a leadership goal, I only really have control over 2 of those. And that's a good thing because the average person that does a personal goal is really bad at figuring out an accurate idea of the timeline and the results. They go, I'm going to run a marathon this week. Or I had a buddy the other day that was like, we should memorize some of the Bible together. And I was like, let's do the entire book of Ephesians. Like, that's a terrible, like, I went from not doing any to the whole book of Ephesians. Like, and I honestly said that. That was my first response. So the benefit of having a leadership goal when you're connected to a company is you're surrounded by people that are good at figuring out real goals with real metrics, with real timelines. So in situations like that, I wouldn't say, no, cut it in half, because I believe you've already done a good job on the upfront, not having a crazy set of results you're looking for. So in that sense, I'd say, you know what, let's focus on the two things you control, which are your actions, which are your motivation. Like, you have more control over those. You know, when I speak to a big sales team, I don't say, hey, cut your goals in half, because I know the benefit of working at a successful company is, guess what? Successful companies are great at results and they're great at timelines. I don't need to worry about those two things. Neither do you. Congratulations. You're part of a big team. What I do need to help you with is your actions and your motivation, because those things you have some control over. So that's the difference.
It's awesome. That's a great answer. And I've heard you talk about that before, but that really strikes home. You know, Jonathan Swiegel's asked us to kind of pass on this idea. And, you know, you've been, I think, really open and about being a father and a husband. And he asked, you know, what does your role as a parent, how does that impact your life as a speaker in terms of the content you produce, in terms of kind of the guardrails that you put on that? And there's this fine line between authenticity and oversharing. And in content, you want to make sure your kids and family are comfortable with.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is it changes as they grow. You know, it's one thing to say, oh, my 2-year-old said a crazy thing. And like, the 2-year-old's not on Twitter. And they're not going to go, you know, when they're 14, they're not going to go back through your Twitter. Like, it's so funny when my friends say, I do all this Instagram so my kids can look at it later. And I always want to say, yeah, when's the last time you went through your parents' wedding album? Like, we don't, like, nobody goes back through archives. Like, so part of it's the age thing. So for instance, if one of my kids did something that I thought was funny, but a little embarrassing, I'll either not do it, or I'll ask them, can I share this? Or can I share it by just saying one of my kids said, so you don't know which kid, like, it becomes a conversation. And I'm not going to hurt our relationship for a laugh or a retweet or a like. And so it becomes a conversation with my kids. What's funny is they now suggest things. They'll go, hey, this would be a good tweet. This would be a funny story. My 15-year-old daughter, I hired her to help me run my Instagram account. She told me one day, Dad, use Instagram like an old man. There's these things you need to do that are different. And I just didn't know. So now it's become a connection point. And my account's so much better because she's helping me with it. So that's part of it. As far as like speaking and travel goes, I'm more deliberate. I told somebody today, I recognize that I have, my youngest daughter's a 7th grader, so I have 5 or 6 years left with her at home, you know, counting on that she goes to college. So I say no to a lot of gigs right now, because I know in 6 years, I can say yes to a lot more when my wife can travel with me and we've got an empty nest. But for right now, I need to be deliberate about that. So I'm deliberate about who I work with and when I work with them and what the schedule is. And so, you know, I'm pretty deliberate about the gigs I'll do. And so that'll change when we're in a different season. And same with, like, it's unfair. Part of where it's unfair is when somebody who has, you know, a 4-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 1-year-old goes, I feel like John gets more done. Well, yeah, I do. Because like on a Saturday, my kids are at lacrosse and they're at lacrosse practice for 2 hours. Or my daughter had play practice Sunday from 12 to 5. So if you have a 1-year-old, guess where they are from 12 to 5? They're with you.
Yep.
Like, if you have a teenager, those are 12 to 5. Like, she's off doing her thing. I can do some, you know, I might be able to read more or write more. So I think a lot of it depends on the season you're in.
That's a great answer. The, you know, as we kind of look at, you know, these seasons, your latest book, I know you're working on a new one, but your latest book, Finish, has impacted so many people's lives. And I give out, then please don't everybody tweet and say, give me a set. But I always, for graduation gifts, I give out Quit or Start, Do Over and Finish as a kind of bound group to young people. And I want to remind them they're gonna have all of those experiences. And I want them to have the guidebook or how to do that. And there's just great lessons in there. There are those things that I'll pick one up and start thumbing through it and go, oh, I forgot that. Man, that's gold. So I want them to have, when they don't know the answer, to at least know somebody cared enough to give them a book that's got the answers in it of those real world problems. And hopefully they look at it.
I usually hide like a $20 bill in one of the books and say, call me when you find this. But it finishes out paperback. We've literally at Southwest Michigan First given out hundreds of copies of it. And I wonder, in that experience of writing Finish, what was kind of the biggest epiphany for you? Because this was kind of the first one where you brought somebody else in and said, let me partner with you on real science and data. And what was that kind of epiphany experience for you?
Yeah, I mean, one, thank you for sharing my books that way. It's very helpful. It's also encouraging in the midst of writing a new one, because I don't care how many books you've written, you always think, I'll never be able to write another book. The last one was the last great idea. And there's always this, you know, anytime you roll around in creativity, there's a cloud of discouragement if you're not careful. So that's very kind for you to say in this exact season I'm in. As far as the research went, I think the surprise, you know, one of the surprising things was that fun mattered. I think having some science behind the idea that it's not only okay to be joyful about your goal, it's necessary for performance, was really, that to me was the biggest surprise, and one that I'm not good in my own life. You know, the story I tell is, my wife said, you're a workaholic, you need a hobby. And so I said, well, I'm going to play ping pong. And I hired a coach, you know, and I immediately squeezed any sense of joy right out of the endeavor. Like, and so I heard somebody recently say, why is it like, why can't we be okay to enjoy something and not be good at it? Like, why do we have to become excellent at the thing? And that's a challenge for me. And so the background of research to say, hey, like, you have the permission to do the thing and just enjoy it. And if you have something you want to finish, you better figure out how to add some joy, because it counts and it matters. And so that was really surprising and a fun. Yeah, the book, I haven't seen a response to any of my books like I've seen to Finish. The other day I got a direct mail or Instagram direct message. That's why I use it like an old man. I said direct mail. I got a postcard in the internet.
Yeah, fax.
Gosh, yeah. I got an internet message. Yeah. And so, but this woman, it was a picture of her hat from graduation, and she had cut out the copy of Finish and put it on her hat. And she said, I want to thank you for helping me finish a degree that took 11 years and while raising two twins. And so like that kind of thing and seeing that response, and it's just been, I haven't met a company yet that said, John, we finished too many things. Like our people finish too much. You know, we want them to finish less. So the thrill for me has been the HR director at a massive company will say, hey, we want you to come in and give our sales team some ideas about finishing. But then also the stay-at-home mom that doesn't feel like she has permission to do something she cares about. Both people are connecting to it. And as an author, that's been really encouraging.
That is, I'm lucky people write me nice notes as well, but I frankly would have to frame that picture in her note. That would go on the wall, because that's the things that get you through those days when you get cut off, you know, in the street and, you know, somebody ran, you know, threw a beer bottle in your yard and, you know, everything just keeps going wrong. And you walk in and you see that and you go, you know what? I didn't just change that woman's life. I changed those two kids' lives.
Oh yeah, and the husband's impacted, and yeah, I'm looking at it right now. I'm sitting. I have a shelf full of books that people finish because they read Finish, and I get notes in them. I get invitations to graduation ceremonies where they say, "Hey, I finished my doctorate. You know, I didn't think I'd get there." And so, yeah, I feel a great sense of joy over that. I feel encouraged. It's just really fun. And so, anybody who's got an idea they want to share, I think you're right. I think we need those encouraging moments to push through the times where you're going to feel like this book's already been written. Like every author ever feels a couple of things. One, I have no real ideas to share. Everybody already knows this. A million people that are smarter with better teeth have written this book. I'm going to run out of words. People are going to see through this. You know, the critiques are going to kill me. Like you feel all that. And to that, I'd say, there's people that need your book you might never even meet. And remember that, like that you're going to put it in there and send it out. And that's part of the joy.
No, you're exactly right. And that's in my new book. I tell a lot of this kind of these stories that several people kind of who pre-read said, are you sure you want to tell these, you know, the fact that I've struggled so long with dyslexia. But I tell them because I was speaking to a group of college football players. And these guys were bigger than, you know, the sky. And after I got done, three of them came up and two of them were crying because they, their whole life had been humiliated, embarrassed because they had learning problems, because they had the same form of dyslexia that I have. But by me describing it, they then realized it wasn't them. It was just a different way that their brain works. And it was one of the most powerful moments of my life. And I thought, I have to tell these stories because other people need them, not because I need to tell them.
Well, and you release them from that identity. Like they had thought that was my identity. Yep. And so, and you can't force that. You get to be invited into that, which is part of being brave. It's one of the things I put this in a book that when you go first with your story, you give other people the gift of going second. And that's a really powerful gift to give somebody because first is hard. You don't know the boundaries. You don't know what's acceptable. You don't know what's too, you know, oversharing, whatever. But when somebody is brave enough to go first, you get to go second. And I've benefited from that where somebody else said something. And I said, oh, whoa, we're able to say that. I mean, I think there's people like Donald Miller that Donald Miller changed the way you could write about certain things. And I thought, oh, I didn't even know that was in play. Like, and that, you know, gave me a great sense of freedom.
Yeah.
And I started this conversation off the air with telling you thanks for all the connections, because I've personally benefited from your willingness to say, I'm going to build a community of thought leaders. Like, I'm going to put Kalamazoo on the map for doing work that really matters, not just for our community, but for the whole country. And I've, you know, we're multi-years into this relationship, but I know that there's events where I go to and I'll say, how'd you hear about me? And they go, Ron Kitchens and Catalyst. And I'll go, of course. So I, you know, I'm a living note back to you.
Hey, thanks. I appreciate that. That really does bring me joy to be able to do that. Last question before we go. You use the word brave, and something that I think was unbelievably brave of you was doing two nights of stand-up. And Larry Lutz wrote in on Twitter and asked about you doing stand-up and will you do it again? Tell us about what drove you to want to have that experience and kind of what you learned from it.
I'd always talked about it. I love comedy. I grew up with a really funny father, really funny brothers, a funny sister. And so I'd always grown up around it. A lot of the people I look up to as communicators are comedians. Gary Goldman is somebody who I really respect, who's a great comedian. And so I wanted to try it. I've been talking about it forever. And I saw an opener for a big famous person that I didn't think was amazing. And I thought, well, I can try that. And I think that's honestly how a lot of things start. I know a lot of businesses where somebody experienced something and said, oh man, I could do real estate better than that. And then they said, and then somebody said, well, then I dare you to try. And so we contacted Zany's in Nashville, which is the biggest comedy club, and said, okay, we're going to do a night. And then the first night sold out. And so we said, okay, we're going to do a second night. And it took me months and months and months and months to write that set. It was a 60-minute set. And I learned a lot. I mean, one, it kicked me out of kind of a creative funk. I was kind of stuck. I wasn't working on a book and was kind of just stuck creatively. And it helped kind of kick my butt out of being stuck. So that was one benefit. The other, I didn't understand how difficult it was. It was very humbling in a good way because I thought, oh, I'm funny on stage. I make people laugh at events, but the differences were massive. Just because when I make somebody laugh in an event, it's almost a surprise. Unless you've seen me before, it's a surprise. When you are at a comedy club, the bar, the entry is you better make me laugh a lot. And so the pressure's different. And I learned about, you know, writing jokes, timing, just little stuff. Like one of the things, if you said, okay, John, if you did it again, what would you change? One of the biggest things I changed was I came out and started with a story, which I think works really well in public speaking. Yep. You see me speak, I come out and I tell a story right out of the gate. Because I think a lot of times people reintroduce themselves. It doesn't make sense. You know, they say like, how's everybody doing? And they waste this important minute. Comedy, which I didn't understand until I did it twice, was like, you need to come out and release some of the tension and interact with the audience. What I should have done, which I did 10 minutes into the speech, but I should have done right out of the gate was, 10 minutes in, I said, hey, let's be honest what we're all thinking. Like, what if I'm terrible? Like, what if I'm only really funny at events for HVAC installers in Plano, Texas, near the airport. Like, what if I'm only contextually funny, but I'm not really funny? And that killed and released the tension. I should have come out right away and said, hey, I know what a lot of us are thinking. There's like, we're here to be supportive, but like, what if I stink? Like, that would have released the tension in the room and given me some of that rapport. Even comedians that do specials come out and you'll see them on Netflix. They say like, oh, Austin, it's so great to be here. Look at this guy in the front row. You wore a hat to my special. Thanks for dressing up. Like, they start, they do a little crowd work. I didn't know that. One, I didn't know it. Two, I didn't have the comedic chops to do it at the time. And so that was, again, humbling because you go, oh, wow, that's different. And also eye-opening. But that's part of the process of doing anything new. One of my big kind of current beliefs, I'm teaching my oldest daughter how to drive. And I think I've written about this. People were riding her tail because she doesn't want to go fast. She's nervous. She takes turns slowly. And so we got a magnet that on the back says student driver. And when you put that on your car, it makes it like it magically transforms jerks into nice people. And I thought, you know what? Like, we all need to put that on the cars of our lives. Like, if I'm writing my first book, I should put a student writer over my desk. Like, if I'm running my first race, my shirt should say student runner. Like, but we expect something before it's there. So when I put that magnet on student comedian, I'm a lot, again, kinder to myself with the results. But I love doing it. I don't think I'm going to do it a lot more. I could see doing it once a year or something like that, or if there was a charity event or something, but it was really informative. I felt like it stretched me. It gave me a different muscle to work on, and I was glad I did it.
So I think that the big takeaway there, I have this theory, philosophy, that every year I pick something that's hard and lonely, something that it's hard for me to do. I've never done it before. I've got to learn. I've got to go deep in it, and I can't assign it to anybody else on my team. I have to do the work. And this seems like one of those hard and lonely things, but in knowing you and watching you progress through this, you mentioned, you know, this was hard work, but you were doing sets at like 8:30 in the morning to like groups, small groups who would come listen as you worked through this. This wasn't, hey, let me write some jokes and show up. And I think that's where a lot of people defer their dreams. They think, okay, I'm deciding I'm going to do it. And then they don't have any idea what the work is that has to go into it. So they don't do the work. They fail. And they go, well, I'm a failure. Well, no, you just didn't go do the work. Are you seeing that or am I completely off?
No, totally. Totally. I mean, I think we're usually surprised by the work. And then I think the other thing is we're kind of ashamed by the work. We think we should be better, faster than we really are. So yeah, it's 7 a.m. I'm in Austin, Texas. It's some terrible, there's flooding and there's 40 people that have showed up early to hear me, you know, read some jokes off of some pieces of paper as I work on this routine. And so, yeah, I think that's necessary. Hard and lonely is a great phrase because I think we want easy in public. And I think that's where writing is challenging to me. You know, like, I think books are hard and lonely. And again, like, I've written 6. I would love to tell you they get easier every time. That hasn't been my experience. If that's somebody else's experience, then that's great. But my experience hasn't been that. Like, everyone has presented its own unique challenge, its own unique temptation to take the easy way out. And I think we're surprised by the work. And then I think what's interesting is we're often ashamed by the work because I think fear says, if you were good, this would be easier. And I think the hard and lonely is a great mantra because it says, no, it's supposed to be hard. It's not like hard. The hard isn't failure. The hard is it's supposed to be hard. It's like whenever I get to fly and there's Marines on the flight, they'll have backpacks and they'll have patches on that say things like embrace the suck. Or like, yeah. I saw one the other day, and it was the suck-a-meter and it was all the way to the right. And so they, you know, and I've heard Marines say the Marines taught me how to be miserable and that's okay. And I think there's a lot to that.
Yep. No, I think so too. We got to do the work. But you do the work every day on social media. And so if people want to follow you on social media, how do they do that?
I'm John Acuff, JonAcuff on both Twitter and Instagram. And then my website is acuff.me. And I think Finish right now is like $11 on Amazon paperback. So it's quite a deal.
Good. And we're going to give away 5 copies of it. So after you hear this podcast, and those are 5 signed copies that John was nice enough to sign for us. So if you will use the hashtag, go to Ron Kitchens on Twitter or Instagram and use the hashtag, I'm a Finisher, we will put you in the pool and get you a copy of Finish. John, I'm pumped that you're going to be with us for Catalyst University June 21st in Kalamazoo. And I'm more pumped that I get to call you my friend. Thanks for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ron. I can't wait to see you guys again.
All right, we'll see you soon.
Ron, that was a great interview with John Acuff. I am excited to see him again in person on June 20th at Catalyst University. What is most exciting for you when you think about John coming back to Kalamazoo?
John's a good friend, and I've been able to share the stage with him outside of Kalamazoo multiple times. And I know that John's going to change people's lives and help them finish their next thing. And which reminds me, you know, don't forget to go to Instagram and hashtag I am a Finisher. That's I am a Finisher on Instagram for a shot at winning one of those 5 autographed books by John. And if you don't get one in the contest, come see us at Catalyst University June 20th, where John will be there and we will sell you a book that John will autograph for you.
Awesome. Thanks, Ron.
See you next week.
Thanks for joining us. We hope today's conversation inspired you to keep moving forward on your leadership journey. To connect with Ron, you can tweet him at Ron Kitchens or send him a message via ronkitchens.com. If you are listening via iTunes, please leave a review. It really helps us connect to you, grow our impact, and keep moving always forward.